For the most part of the Philippine economic history, agriculture had been the largest and the most important sector. Its share in the country's income from the Spanish colonial period through the earliest decades of the 20th century far exceeded that of the manufacturing and service sectors. The tragic irony, however, is that despite this massive economic contribution and the fact that the majority of the Filipino population were farmers and agricultural workers in the past, the peasants and the farmers remained as the most economically disadvantaged sector. Aside from this, the country's agricultural sector remained to lag behind its Southeast Asian counterparts in the recent decades. Land reform, that is primarily anchored on the principle of equal distribution of resources, has been a key program of Filipino presidency since the time of Manuel Quezon. But why have these programs failed to deliver on its promises? Let's talk about this in this episode. Because landlessness and rural poverty,
food insecurity,
underdeveloped agriculture and agro-industry,
hindi na bago yan. I am Aaron Maliari.
I am Liken Delaria.
And I'm Veg Alporja, and you are listening to Podcast, Conversations on Philippine History, Politics, and Society.
Hello sa inyong lahat and welcome back. This is already the penultimate episode of our fourth season. Pero huwag kayong mag-alala because there are a lot more issues in the pipeline na pag-uusapan pa namin. So watch out.
That's right. So ma-excite kayo dahil habang mapalapit ang eleksyon, Podcast will certainly not shy away from talking about the most important and relevant issues in the Philippines today.
And of course, speaking of important issues, we cannot skip the perennial issue of agrarian reform and agriculture in the country. Historians, ideologues, scholars, and activists would always place agriculture at the center of the country's economic, social, and political life. And for good reasons. Our entry to the world market, for example, was through cash crop agriculture or cash crop economy. And later on, historians like Teodoro Agoncillo would say that the Philippine Revolution against Spain was mainly manned by Filipino peasants in the hopes that the friar estates would be distributed among them once narapatalsik ang mga Kastila.
At magpapatuloy ang mga peasant unrest na ito to the American period hanggang sa Third Republic. Pinaka-prominent syempre ay ang Hook Rebellion sa Central Luzon na hindi nagapi hanggang 1950s. At kinailangan pa nga na magkaroon ng tulong from the United States para talagang matigil ang rebellion.
But as mentioned in the intro, for the most part, maraming mga problemang pang-agraryo o may kinalaman sa agrikultura ang nagpapatuloy hanggang sa kasalukuyan. So in this episode, bibigyan din natin yung estado ng land reform or agrarian reform na noon pa pinoproyekto ng pamahalaan. So ano na ang lagay nito at ano ang naging impact niya sa realidad ng mga mag-asaka at iba pang agricultural workers na actually kasama rin pati mga fisher folks?
And to do that, we are joined by a sociologist who recently acquired her doctorate in sociology at the National University of Singapore, where she is also currently working as a teaching assistant. At ito ay walang iba kundi si Dr. Veronica Gregorio.
So si Dr. Nikki Gregorio ay nag-aral ukol sa mga farming families sa Southeast Asia, particular sa Pilipinas at sa Malaysia. So yung mga ibabahagi sa atin ni Nikki, very insightful kasi hindi lang nakatuon sa agrarian reform situation sa Pilipinas, pero sinasagot din ito yung tanong na nasaan nga ba ang Pilipinas sa agrarian reform kung imamapa sa rehiyon. So, let's listen to Nikki as she talks about the meaning and scope of land reform in Southeast Asia.
When we talk about agrarian reform, we need to identify first ano ba yung mga kasama ng agrarian reform. Mm-hmm. So, sa land distribution, support sa farmers, and pati sa fisher folks, right? Yan yung mga included sa agrarian reform. So, maybe I'll start na lang around the 1960s, perhaps, yung National Agricultural Agencies, they began to implement Green Revolution policies actually sa Southeast Asia. So that's Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, Vietnam. So ito yung mga pinakamadaming data actually if we're going to focus on Southeast Asia. So at first, it's kind of slow yung development ng agricultural policies. But mid-1970s, medyo nag-intensify din yung approach. And for instance, in Malaysia, they implemented the new economic policy. And from that, may mga specific programs to actually encourage the population to support the agricultural sector. Okay, and the state itself offered families some occupancy titles, okay, to clear and use lands for agricultural expansion. So they offer, it really worked actually for Malaysia. Families from northern regions of Malaysia, they actually move to other regions, east or sa south, where the government is offering land for paddy cultivation. So mga rice farming families to. And so yeah, that's for Malaysia. And even in Vietnam naman, mid-1980s, they have this renewal of agricultural policies. And the priority there is yung irrigation and mechanization ng agriculture. And now, the largest rice exporter na yung Vietnam. And actually, nagtatalo lang sila ng Thailand. So yan yung dalawa sa Southeast Asia na rice exporters. And in terms of sa national budget, actually, for Vietnam, they allocate 6%. And yung Thailand, 4%. Okay, a little bit lower. Pero if you will compare sa Philippines, 1.7 lang tayo. Actually, some economists would say 2%, but no, it's only 1.7, right? So, yeah, yan yung sa mga rice exporting countries. Tapos yung palm oil naman, yun yung main agricultural products para sa Indonesia and Malaysia, right? So, yeah, and going back lang sa Philippines, nagkaroon din tayo ng mga resettlement programs, actually, especially nung panahon ni President Magsaysay. Yung mga families actually from Ilocos, Cebu, they were offered land ownership sa southern Philippines. And some scholars, of course, they would argue that this is also because of the peasant unrest during that period. But the point is, nagkaroon nga ng land distribution. And similar siya sa Malaysia, right? Now, with that information, bakit parang hindi nagbabago yung kalagayan ng farmers sa Philippines? Kasi Malaysia's government is actually in control of the policy implementation from the formation of cooperatives to the pricing of agricultural products. So sila yung nagtatakda noon. So it's not perfect. May mga Malaysian economists pa din na nagsasabi na kulang pa yung structural support for the farmers. But compared to Philippines, medyo mas organized. Okay, yung implementation ng reforms sa Malaysia. So, sa Philippines, although may mga na-distribute na land titles, we know for a fact na majority pa rin ng farmers ay landless. Okay? So, they are farm workers, but they are not farm owners. Okay? And syempre, most importantly, yung development strategies sa agrarian reform ay mas inclined na mag-encourage ng private sector participation, okay, at foreign investments. Yan yung mga priority eh. So hindi naman yung masama, pero yung government control kasi ay mahalaga para hindi maisahan or malugi yung farmers.
So kung ikukumpara sa mga kapitbahay natin, pwede talagang sabihin na napag-iwanan ng Pilipinas pagdating sa agrarian reform. And this is not just in terms of land distribution, but also on government programs to really give the agricultural sector the necessary push. And I think this is well embodied by the fact that the allocated budget on agriculture in the Philippines only accounts for 1.7% of our GDP. Diba? Wala pa sa kalahati ng 4% ng Thailand at wala pa sa 1/3 ng 6% ng Malaysia.
So yung mga agrarian reform programs, iba-iba yan sa iba-iba ring historical period. So for example, noong panahon ni President Manuel Quezon, yung programa para sa reformang agraryo ay nakapaloob sa kanyang social justice program. So the Commonwealth government under Quezon tried to regulate tenancy para maprotektahan kahit paano yung mga tenants. And at the same time, they also established credit facilities for farmers. So aside from that, nagsimula din dito yung pagbili ng mga hacienda supposedly para ipamahagi sa mga tenants and the establishment of agencies to assist farmers on land disputes and so on. Later into the century, post-war presidents would focus naman on resettlement programs para din matugunan yung mga peasant unrest. So the government started facilitating resettlement of landless families at binigyan sila ng parcels of land for them to farm and cultivate.
This was made possible through agencies like the National Resettlement and Rehabilitation Administration, or yung NARA, which really accelerated the resettlement programs. Particularly, nakatuon ito sa mga magsasaka na naging bahagi ng Hook Rebellion. So, ang goal ay kumbinsihin sila na lisanin ang Central Luzon and resettle in other places as peaceful citizens. So, kung napakinggan nyo ang previous episode natin on Bangsamoro, marirealize natin na may iba pang naging kabahagi, kakabit na issue yung resettlement programs na yan. Lalo na sa Mindanao. But anyway, during the early 60s, sa presidency ni Diosdado Macapagal, nabuo naman yung Agricultural Land Reform Code. At dito, tenancy was supposedly abolished and tenant farmers were converted to lessees and later on, owner-cultivators. The idea was to turn these tenants into independent farmers and to improve on productivity and expand land distribution.
So in principle, maganda ito, no? Pero as usual, anong naging problema? Kahit na ipasa na yung batas, hindi siya na-implement ng maayos kasi hindi naman pinaglaan ng budget ng Kongreso na syempre binubuo ng mga kongresista na nagmula sa landed families. So when Marcos assumed the presidency and declared martial law on his second term, nilatag niya naman yung Presidential Decree No. 27 o yung Code of Agrarian Reform of the Philippines. Ito yung code behind the famous rice and corn land program ni Marcos. Dito ginawa yung tinawag niyang Operation Land Transfer. Yung idea ay, yung mga lupain na 7 hectares and above na tinatanaman ng rice or corn ay ibibigay sa mga tenants o sa mga magasaka. So makikita natin that the agrarian reform under Marcos focused on rice. Ito na yung Masagana 99 or yung Rice Self-Sufficiency Program.
And apart from the distribution of rice and corn lands, may iba pang features yung Masagana 99. So for example, it allowed farmers to access bank credits para makabili ng agricultural inputs at ng mga maliliit na lupa or yung mga abono, mga binhi, ganyan. So it was actually a promising and a really ambitious program. So yung tanong, saan sumabit ang initiative na to? Ano? Well, dahil focused nga ang agrarian reform program na to sa rice and corn, the land-owning elite found a really simple way to circumvent the law. So simple lang, para di ma-subject ang kanilang estate sa reforma, they changed their crop. So from rice, halimbawa, landlords shifted to sugar or coconuts. So isa pang buta sa Marcosian land reform ay yung mga lupain lang na sinasaka ng tenant farmers yung subject sa distribution. So anong ginawa ng mga landlords? They evicted their tenants and hired farm workers. So technically, hindi daw tenants yung mga yon, farm workers sila. So mas dumami pa ngayon yung mga nawalan ng lupa. So madami pa siyempre yung mga agricultural crises na nangyari nung panahon na to na arguably ay ibinunsod ng korupsyon na kinasangkutan ng mga Marcos cronies.
Oh, 'di ba? Ito na nga, Marites, no? So nung 1980s, mangyayari yung Negros Famine caused by the actions of the Marcos crony and the chief of the National Sugar Trading Corporation or yung NASUTRA na si Roberto Bobby Benedicto. Hagard ng name drop tayo, ano? So, ano bang nangyari? Actually, confluences of factors yan. Mid-1970s, the sugar that the Philippine imports to the US dropped down from 1.2 million tons a year to 330,000 tons. This was in 1974, the year when the Laurel Langley Pact expired. At the same time, in the same period, 1975, bumaba din ang European demand because they developed the manufacture of beet sugar. So, syempre, bumagsak din ang presyo ng asukal. From 65 cents per pound, bumaba yung presyo to around 40 cents per pound na lang. Pero ang nag-exacerbate talaga niyan, si Bobby Benedicto. At least some scholars say. Kasi he gambled on sugar prices, no? So for some reasons, he was convinced na tataas ang presyo ng asukal from 65 cents per pound to $1 per pound noon ngang 1974 to 1975. So he hoarded it, no? So hindi niya binenta. Sobrang daming asukal yung hinold niya, hinold niya talaga sa maraming mga warehouse.
And then what happened instead was, the market crashed and Benedicto was eventually forced to sell at 10 cents per pound. So sobrang talo, no? Actually, nakaka-agit tong part na to ng Marcos regime. Kasi ang pinaka-nagdusa dito ay yung sugar plantation workers, eh. So lugi yung nasutra, hindi nila nabayaran yung mga planters, at syempre yung planters, hindi mababayaran yung mga tenants or yung mga workers nila. So ang resulta, gutom talaga. Famine which affected 1 million people. Imagine people literally...
Golden age pa more.
Yeah. Imagine people literally dying of hunger dahil lamang sa kapalpakan at korupsyon ng mga crony at ng Marcos government. And sobrang jarring, no, na parang isang matamis na bagay yung nagdulot ng gutom or nung bitterness sa buhay ng mga taong ito. Tapos makikita mo yung naglipa ng revisionist na mga post sa Facebook or yung mga TikTok. Grabe kung ipagpag yung Presidential Decree number 27 tsaka yung Masagana 99. So makikita mo dito, no, na yung mga polisiya talaga na di pinag-aralang mabuti, pumapalpak pagdating sa implementation, lalong-lalo na kung hahaluan ng korupsyon. Siguro pwedeng i-argue na itong agricultural crisis sa Negros sa nagbunsod ng malawak na kagutuman ay isa din sa mga nagpahina ng legitimacy ni Marcos kasi na-involve din talaga ang international community at mga NGOs sa response. Anyway, by 1986, we know that Marcos was ousted and with the new democratic government came a new agrarian reform program. So ito na nga yung Comprehensive Agrarian Reform Program na bunga naman ng RA 6657 passed in 1988.
So after EDSA, parang, you know, hopes are high for a more meaningful agrarian reform program. Despite the fact, of course, that President Cory Aquino came from the old landed Cahuangco clan in Central Luzon. Kasi syempre, in the euphoria of the people power, people saw that the Aquino government was something brought about by the, you know, unleashing of various social forces, social movements that really could potentially restructure the Philippine society. And ano nga ba yung ano pa yung mas ano ba mas makahulugan, more meaningful restructuring than a real redistribution of resources, lalong-lalo na yung lupa. Okay? So in fact, the Comprehensive Agrarian Reform Law or CARL at this time was dubbed as the single most important piece of government legislation. Pero kahit ganon, talagang never namang nagsilbi ang agrarian reform or itong CARL or CARP bilang framework of development sa Pilipinas. So, and of course, dahil dyan, the CARP of 1988 delivered really dismally.
And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. At the end of Cory's term, 22.5% lang ng mga land na for distribution ang actually naipamahagi. Siyempre, isa sa mga dagdag na kontrobersya pa dyan ay yung fact na yung Hacienda Luisita na pagmamay-ari ng mga Cahuangco ay na-exempt sa CARP. So the succeeding governments from Ramos to Duterte in many ways all fell short in delivering meaningful land reforms. Higit 3 decades na since the CARP and more than 10 years na din since yung tinatawag na CARPer. Di pa din na-distribute ang lahat ng lupa. At kagaya nga ng sinabi ni Nikki, bukod pa dito sa pag-underdeliver sa land distribution, the government is severely underspending in the agriculture sector.
So far, nung makikita natin sa discussion natin na meron tayong mahabang kasaysayan ng reformang pang-agraryo, nagsimula pa kay Quezon. Siguro nga nauna tayong magkaroon ng ganyang konsepto kumpara sa mga kapitbahay natin sa Southeast Asia, no? So, ang tanong ngayon, ano ang naging problema? Nikki identifies 2 problems.
I'll give two points na lang, no? So first, may poor implementation talaga ng land reform programs. And when we say poor implementation, sobrang complicated kasi may mga legal restrictions. Diba? Na kapag hindi na-dissect or napaintindi dun sa mga farmers natin, biglang yung lands na dapat i-award sa kanila or itatransfer sa kanila, nasabihin lang na may glitch, may technicalities, ganyan. May hindi ka napirmahan or may hindi ka nabayaran for 1 month. Yung ganyang mga complications. Tapos, minsan may errors din sa mga land reform coverage or yung mga beneficiary identification dahil sa kawalan ng records or sasabihin lang ng mga local offices na dapat nagdi-distribute ng lands, sabihin nila na, ay, hindi po kayo kasama sa list. Diba? Parang may magic list eh. Tapos, walang magawa yung farmers, diba? Dahil nga, nakadepende sa titles na meron sila. So yun yung first, yung poor implementation ng land reform programs. And second, actually this one, I have observed kasi I watch the interviews for our presidential candidates. Interviews ng Agri 2022. So, yung second, yung goal kasi ng government is very towards agribusiness. Okay, kailangan maging enterprise yung approach sa agriculture, which is not bad, of course. But they are doing this, they are planning this without properly engaging the farming families on the ground who are doing subsistence agriculture ever since. So ang hirap nga naman na biglang sasabihin mo sa kanila na rice farming sila or vegetable farming sila and sabihin mo na mas lalaki po ang kita kapag garlic ang tinanim ninyo. And farmers will be like, what? Why are we gonna risk? Like, why are we gonna do that, right? Kung nabuhay namin yung buong pamilya namin for decades doing this, there should be something, di ba? Para maparisk mo yung farmers na mag-iba ng produkto nila. So, yung dalawang yan, I think, main reasons, no? Kung bakit na napag-iiwanan tayo. So, for instance, sa Malaysia, yung mga cooperatives, may mga government representatives talaga na lumalapit at i-offer yung kung may babaguhin sa products nila. I-offer kung saan ito mapupunta, paano yung bentahan, tinutulungan magbenta yung mga small farming communities. At sa Philippines, sinusubukan din gawin yon, pero yung approach kasi ay depende per local government. So, kailangan din ng close coordination, local saka national, di ba? Kasi minsan ang ganda-ganda naman talaga pakinggan ng mga policies sa national, tapos pagbaba ng local, nag-iiba siya. So, yun yung mga factors na dapat pag-isipan din natin.
So, implementation and a very enterprise-based approach from the government. Imbis na magsilbi ang gobyerno bilang pinakamalakas na investor sa agricultural production ng bansa, ipinapasa sa private sector at sa foreign investors yung responsibilidad na yon. We can say no, na very neoliberal itong ganitong approach.
Agree. Nabanggit natin yan sa earlier episode with JC Punong Bayan, yung pag-underspend ng gobyerno in terms of, you know, investing on certain sectors and industries, kabilang na yung agrikultura. Sabi rin ni Nikki, hindi naman masama yung pag-encourage sa private investors, pero at the same time, kailangan mamuhuna ng pamahalaan in terms of agricultural input, in terms of equipment, pati na din sa paglalagay ng maayos at organisadong administrative processes. Ngayon, mayroon sa discussion na disadvantage at maraming pagkukulang sa agrarian reform sa Pilipinas. Pero at this point, mahalaga na maunawaan natin ano yung talagang epekto nitong mga pagkukulang na to sa buhay ng mga magsasaka. So, si Nikki, she shares how small landholders are affected by the utter lack of government support to agriculture.
Definitely, no? In terms of my research kasi, I focus on smallholders. So when we say smallholders, these are rural families owning small holdings 3 hectares and below. Ano lang, maliit na lupa lang, ganyan. So economically speaking, within the rural population, nasa gitna yung smallholders. Like, they are not as poor as the landless farmers, but of course, they are not as rich as the landlords or the plantation owners, right? So, based on my fieldwork, I'll focus on that. And yung situation nila actually up and down, you know, and very dependent sa production ng farm. Pero there are ways then that they cope and persist. Okay, and maybe I'll go there dun sa mga mas sociological na aspects na nakita ko sa research ko. So first, there's this what we call occupational multiplicity, okay? Or tinatawag din siyang pluriactivity. So, yung pluriactivity within the household, nakita ko to when I interviewed some farmers na actually tricycle drivers rin. At paminsan, delivery truck drivers pa Davao City. So, my research is in Davao del Sur. Okay? And yeah, so pluriactivity meaning hindi lang sila dumedepende sa farming. Okay, so before, yes, but now, ini-stretch talaga nila yung sarili nila para yung vacant nila ay makahanap pa sila ng ibang pagkakitaan. Okay, so pluriactivity, isa yan. Yeah, some women farmers pa nga, kasambahay sila pag weekdays, tapos farmers sila pag weekends. Okay, so may mga times sa fieldwork ko na parang, okay lang ba, ano, yung interview natin gagawin habang nagma-manicure pedicure ako ng kapitbahay. So, ay, wala pong problema, ganyan. Basta okay lang sa kapitbahay, di ba? Or minsan nag-rear bond ng buhok ng kapitbahay. Okay lang. So nakikita mo eh na dahil dun sa limits ng economic benefits sa farming, naghahanap sila ng ibang ways, di ba? So ito 'yon. Tapos second is via migration. Okay, so yung smallholders kasi they are better off than the landless families. So in a sense, sila yung nakakaipon and minsan nakakapag-invest, right? Para yung family members ay makalipad overseas. Okay, so one thing that that I learned from fieldwork is that while nasa ibang bansa yung ibang family members, syempre patuloy na inaalagaan yung family farm. Because it's small, okay? It's only 3 hectares and below. But it's something na pinamana, right? Like, mula pa sa nanay ng nanay ng nanay, right? Panahon pa ni Magsaysay. Kasi nga, na-move sila doon eh. Panahon ni Magsaysay. Tapos, so yung family, meron silang sense ng value sa farm na hindi economic, but very social. Okay, na okay, sakto-sakto lang yung kinikita natin dito, but this is a legacy of our grandparents. We will not sell this.
So, for small landholding families, ang epekto sa kanila nito ay napupwersa sila to engage in various occupations para lang mapagkasya yung income nila. Farming simply doesn't cut it. So, ang hirap talaga. Now, Nikki compares this to the Malaysian experience.
So in terms of the landless farmers, ang epekto kasi niyan eh kapag landless ka, nakadepende ka sa demand, 'di ba, ng mga may lupa. Nakadepende ka sa demand ng plantation owners. And kapag nabalitaan na nag-join ka ng mga progressive organizations or anything, hindi ka kukunin, hindi ka i-hire, 'di ba? So medyo connected eh yung landlessness, sa economic, syempre gusto nila ng work, tapos sa political din. Kasi while it's helpful sana na ma-organize yung farmers, kasi pag sinabing organize naman, magiging familiar ka sa policies at saka sa rights mo, di ba? Pero dahil naiipit sila na hindi sila kukunin ng mga plantation owners or ng mga landowners kapag nag-join sila, mas lalo tuloy wala silang correct na information, di ba, about the land reform programs. So, ang impact nun, edi, hindi sila magkakaroon ng lupa kahit buong pamilya nila ay dekada nang nagsasaka sa same na lupa, di ba? Hindi nila yun magiging property ever. So, mas ganun ang impact na.
Medyo nakaka-depress yun, ano, yung kwento ni Nikki na sa Malaysia, di na sila nagma-manual harvesting. At dun sa fact na may time sila talaga na makapagpahinga at makapag-venture freely sa ibang mga bagay kasi di nila kailangan kumayod ng sobra-sobra just to survive.
Tama, no? Sobrang nakakainggit. Pero kung iisipin, mas maginhawa pa itong mga small landholders na to kumpara sa mga landless peasants talaga. Ito naman yung kwento ni Nikki tungkol sa struggle naman nila.
Yung una, hindi ka makapagpaaral ng mga anak consistently. Like, pa-stop-stop yung education, diba? And ano yun, syempre may impact yun sa learning eh, kung every other year you meet to ka ng pag-aaral. Tapos yung pangalawa, nagre-risk sila na lumipad, or not lumipad, like pumunta sa mga city. Sila yung mga nagiging urban poor. Diba? So, I remember sa Tondo, sa Vitas Tondo, I did some interviews there, and pag tinanong mo yung, kasi mahilig akong magtanong about family history. So pag tinanong mo kung saan sila galing, provinces, no? Samar, Negros, Cebu, dyan galing yung mga na-interview ko na naging urban poor sa Tondo. So may mga nawalan ng lupa, nabenta, nasangla, hindi nila natubos, at yung bahay nila nakatayo dun sa lupa na yun. So naging homeless sila. And ang kaya na lang gawin ay mula din sa maliit na ipon or utang, 'di ba? Mula sa mga kapitbahay, pumunta ng Manila. Okay? Tapos ang options diyan magkasambahay. Tapos kita ng onte, makaupa somewhere sa mga urban poor neighborhoods, ganyan. So actually pag binalikan talaga yung history din ng mga urban poor communities, mga landless sila eh, na farmers from outside of Manila. So, yun. Nag-migrate sila pa Manila. And yeah, sila yung nagiging urban poor.
So, talagang kawing-kawing yung mga issue, ano? Una, yung kakayanan ng mga mag-asaka na mag-organisa ng kanilang mga sarili. This is determined by their position economically. So, para siyang nagiging vicious cycle. They can't organize themselves, then they can't be aware and fight for their rights, and so they're trapped in that state of landlessness. Tapos for others naman, nauuwi din talaga sa mga desperate measures like, ayun, makikipagsapalaran sa cities kung saan nagiging bahagi naman sila ng urban poor communities.
Indeed, at dahil ganito nga yung epekto ng kakulangan ng maayos na programa for agrarian reform, panahon na to see agrarian reform not just as a program for the agricultural sector, but as a framework for inclusive development that really starts from the principle of wealth distribution. So ngayon, katulad ng iba nating episodes, tanungin natin, ano ba ang plano ng mga kumakandidato sa agrarian reform at agrikultura? Let's hear Nikki's assessment at ang kanyang recommendations.
Maybe I'll say a bit first, no, dun sa mga interviews nina VP Lenny, nina Senator Marcos, sa kanina Mayor Isko. Yan kasi yung tatlong napanood ko eh. So nakapaghain sila ng mga agenda nila, ganyan, nasagot nila yung ibang questions. And I think yung halimbawa yung kay VP Lenny, very specific na sinabi niya, actually nadadoblehin niya yung budget na i-allocate para sa agriculture sector. So that's good. Music to the ears, di ba? Kapag ganyan. Na, actually, sinabi din naman ni Mayor Isko yun. Na, kasi yan naman yung mga common na promise, di ba? But while budget is important, ako, I would say na yung specifics na paggagamitan ng budget ay kailangan maidetalye din. Okay, so ang isang observe ko si Bongbong, halimbawa, yung kanya mas ang sagot niya sa interviews very related sa nutrition. Okay, yung agriculture ni-relate niya sa kung paano ba magkaroon ng healthy nation. Okay, so that's not bad then. Magandang ano 'yon, maganda din. Pero I think mas ano pa rin eh, connected pa rin sa Nutribond projects before. So, yeah. Tapos si Lenny naman, madami siyang specific na na-share about sa pwedeng maging benefits para sa mga kababaihang magsasaka. So, very grounded din yung experience ni VP Lenny. So, yung aspect na paano ba pwedeng i-support further yung mga kababaihan in terms of trainings and all na makakatulong economically, nandun din siya. So, yeah, I guess yung electoral platforms, pwede siyang palawakin pa. Okay, for sure naman pinag-isipan to lahat eh. Yung mga binanggit nila sa interview, pinag-isipan mabuti ng kanilang team. So maybe one thing then na pwedeng i-add ay yung added support sa fisher folks. Okay, kasi when we talk about agriculture naman, kasama dun yung mga mangisda eh. Diba? So, yeah, may mga industry na nakakaligtaan or nakakalimutan na nawawala na. Si Mayor Isko, sabi niya, yung seaweed industry, gusto niyang ibalik. Kasi, dati naman, exporter yung Philippines eh. Pero ngayon, hindi na. So, may something doon na nangyari. Kailangan pag-aralan paano ulit mapapakinabangan yung seaweed industry sa Philippines. And siguro, in terms of support sa fisher folks, support in terms ng i-mechanize din, 'di ba? Yung ating mga bangka para hindi naman konting bagyo or something, 'di ba? Lulubog yung mga bangka ng mga mangisda natin, at saka yung support sa mga mas bago na kagamitan. Ganyan. So sa fisher folks, 'yon makakatulong. Tapos ako as a sociologist, as a researcher, I know you will agree din naman na mahalagang point na sinasabi ng mga presidential candidates yung land consolidation. Pero for me, mahalaga din yung data consolidation, no? Kasi yung policies, 'di ba? Para mabuo siya, kailangan mo ng data. And minsan nawawala kasi yung data gathering sa iba't ibang agencies para makabuo ka ng policies, ganyan. So highly advised na makipag-coordinate. For sure, madami yan. Erie sa UPLB, 'di ba? UP Visayas para sa maritime industry. Masyadong mabilis yung paggather ng data, like yung mga social relations na mahalaga pala within the farmers, right? So ayon, and lastly, this is something na galing sa fieldwork ko. Napakahalaga ng promotion ng agriculture sa mga high school. Okay, so in my fieldwork sa Davao del Sur, nag-visit ako at nag-interview ako ng teachers sa isang rural high school. So yeah, so they teach students ng about different livelihoods related to agriculture. Hindi lang farming eh. Kasi yung mga bata naman sa rural communities, nakikita nila yan, yung farming. Pero halimbawa, animal husbandry o kaya food production, ganyan, kasama siya sa rural high school.
So support for fisher folks and for the maritime industry, data consolidation to aid legislation and policy making, and increased support on agricultural education through rural high schools and higher education institutions. Yan ang recommendations ni Dr. Nikki Gregorio as a rural sociologist. I think all of these recommendations can be subsumed under one framework: greater state investment. So, hindi talaga uubra na iaasa lang sa private sector at sa foreign investments. Matuto tayo sa karanasan ng ibang Southeast Asian countries na talagang napaunlad ang agricultural industry at na-achieve ang, in many ways, kung matatawag man siya, na food security.
And that concludes the 9th episode for the season of Hindi na Bago Yan. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Veronica Nikki Gregorio of the National University of Singapore for joining our conversation and lending her expertise on this issue. If you're interested to listen to the full interview, you can find it on our website, podcast.org.
And all of our episodes are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. So subscribe to our channel, Podcast TV.
Let's continue our conversations on social media. Kung meron kayong mga tanong, suggestions, comments, and feedback, you may follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And if you like this episode, i-share nyo naman sa inyong mga friends and followers. So maraming salamat for joining us today, and see you next week. And as always, have a good day.